Welcome to True Crime Therapist. I am Melissa Rondo, your host and mental health therapist. Join me as I speak with those directly impacted by true crime, including survivors, FBI agents, and the family members. Through raw and personal conversations, we analyze the long-lasting effects of trauma as well as the root psychological issues behind these heinous acts. I am your true crime therapist. Welcome to all my listeners. This is episode one of True Crime Therapist. As a mental health therapist, I'm on a mission to promote trauma awareness in the world of true crime and how true crime impacts all of those involved on a very personal level. My goal is every episode will leave you feeling fascinated by the questions and answers, giving you deeper insight into the personal world of true crime. I am professionally trained in clinical interviewing and will use as much skill as possible to draw out psychoeducation. Listener discretion is involved as each episode contains sensitive topics and information. In this episode, I will be interviewing retired BAU criminal profiler Julia Cowley. This interview is not a case review, but a more personal exploration of how her job impacted her personally. I wondered, after reviewing cases of serial murder, would Julia go out running alone in the woods? Find out the answer to this and much more. If you enjoy the episode, please consider giving me a 5-star review and positive feedback. Now on to the show. So hello to everybody that is listening today. I am joined with my guest, retired FBI criminal profiler Julia Cowley. Hi, Julia.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for being here.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
So as you know, it was my dream to work for the FBI and be a profiler, but I didn't have the confidence. So this is an extra meaningful conversation with me. So I'm really excited to talk to you today.
I'm excited to talk to you as well. And I started out too, and I don't feel that I had a lot of confidence either. And I think becoming a part of the FBI helped to build that confidence as well.
Yes, I could totally see that. Yeah. And that's a good segue into, like, if you want to take some time right now into introducing yourself, and maybe just for people that don't know what criminal profiling is, maybe just mention briefly a case you worked on so people can really understand what profiling is.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I'm Julia Cowley, retired FBI agent and profiler, as you mentioned, and I spent 22 years in the FBI. Prior to that, I was a forensic scientist with the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. And when I first joined the FBI, I worked white-collar crime, public corruption, and civil rights cases. And I was also a member of the FBI's evidence response team, so I was able to keep up my forensic skills in that capacity as a member of the team. And then I joined the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit, which is the unit that provides behaviorally based operational support to federal, state, and local agencies that have unsolved crimes or unusual types of crimes, bizarre or repetitive types of crimes. And most people know the BAU as the unit that would be involved in investigations of serial killers. They do a lot more than that, but I was assigned to the unit, the Crimes Against Adults unit. So we did have cases involving serial killers. And I would say probably my claim to fame would be the Golden State Killer case. And that was a case that was assigned to me as a profiler. And as most people know at this point, or people who follow true crime, know the Golden State Killer was ultimately identified as Joe DeAngelo, who was a former police officer at one point in his life during his series of crimes. So that's a little bit of background about me and the BAU and a brief overview of my career.
Nice. Thank you. And I'm sure a lot of people, when they hear that he was a former police officer, it gives people a moment of pause.
It does. It does. And, you know, his crimes reflected some of his training. It was very interesting. And when we ultimately found out who he was and his background, it was like, yeah, I guess that makes sense now.
You mean like his skills with like using a firearm or
yes,
things like that?
Exactly. Yeah. His crimes reflected what we thought was some training that he had, specific training, the use of firearms and tactical skills, his ability to avoid apprehension. So that ended up, you know, not being too much of a surprise to us that he had that background and that training.
Well, that's an incredible case that you worked on. I'm sure many people will be familiar with it. I agree. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the training from the FBI. So as you know, as a mental health therapist, I have to learn about personality disorders, and most, if not all, serial killers are psychopathic. I was curious if the FBI has trainings for profilers that include learning about all these different types of personality disorders.
We do. When you first enter the unit at the FBI, you're part of the unit, but you're not what we would call a certified profiler. And the certification process is quite extensive. It's about 16 weeks of classroom work, which would include instruction in some of the areas that you mentioned, including abnormal psychology and forensic medicine. And there's so much. There's a lot that we go over during the training. And not only that, we also interweaved into that instruction are actual case examples that are presented to us throughout our training. And we have outside experts that come in and provide training to us. So experts that would be experts in child psychology or psychopathy or trauma to the brain. We spent a week at a medical examiner's office in training as well. So it's quite extensive. And then after that, one thing I will mention about the training is that it's for all the different profilers that are coming into those units at the time. So those of us that were selected to certain units with certain expertise, like crimes against adults, crimes against children, terrorism, cyber threats, we all receive that same 16 weeks of training. So it's a lot of overview. But then after that, it's about a year or two of going back into your specific unit and working with certified profilers, sort of in an apprenticeship. And you work cases with a mentor, and you have to work a certain number of cases and specific types of investigations. And then once you complete all that, and it can take a while, it takes, right, depending on the kinds of cases you get, depending on your dedication to getting the training done, it can take anywhere from a full 1 to 2 years to receive your certification.
Well, that sounds like an amazing training program.
It was fantastic. I loved every minute of it, to be honest. It was, even just sitting there in the classroom, it seems very daunting, 16 weeks every day in the classroom, but it was all very fascinating to me. And some of it I was familiar with because of my background in forensics, but then there are some that was brand new to me. So I learned so much through the process.
How important was learning about different personality disorders, about narcissism or being psychopathic? How helpful was that when you were profiling the behavior, during a case that you're analyzing?
Yeah, it's really important for us to understand those personality disorders. But the one thing I want to stress is that our job is not to diagnose anyone. We don't have that ability to do that. So we don't necessarily, if we do a profile of an individual or unknown offender in a crime, we won't say, oh, this person is a narcissist or this person is a psychopath, because that requires extensive examination and evaluation by, an expert in that. But we may observe, the crimes that they committed, observe certain personality traits and characteristics that are in line with those personality disorders. So that's what I want to clarify. So we're not necessarily labeling anybody, but we're just describing the behavior that we see and what their personality traits and characteristics might be to people that know them, that they might recognize in these people.
Right. Yeah. And I agree.
If that makes sense.
Yes. Yes. Even as a therapist, I can, like, when I'm working with a client who might have, let's say, a partner who has certain traits, it helps me to also understand someone's trauma because I can link what my client is experiencing at home, right? Like what kind of behaviors that I'll just say she might be experiencing or witnessing. And then that also helps me to understand the trauma that she's experiencing. Mm-hmm. And I'm stereotyping for a minute. I know that, but that's typically what I have seen in my practice. Another area that I thought was really interesting, and I know I've shared with you that, like, for example, I think it's really fascinating, right, to look at the childhood of someone who is engaging in serial killing. Like, what happened in this child's, in this offender's childhood? Does the FBI conduct any research to compile information to see if there's a link between certain things in childhood? Maybe we can prevent it or provide education. And I was curious if there's any research.
Yes. So there's also a separate unit at the BAU that is dedicated to research. And there have been various studies over the years and research projects and interviews of offenders and interviews of people that maybe knew these offenders as they're growing up to try to determine, okay, what caused them to become a serial killer or to engage in the behaviors that they ended up engaging in. So yes, so there is research dedicated to that. But what I will tell you though is we really don't know what causes it. There's certain things that might be similar in these individuals' backgrounds, but there are also some that they're outliers and they just can't figure out like what did go wrong. We don't really know. I mean, certainly some of the offenders that we've dealt with suffered significant abuse and trauma as children. Mm-hmm. But then there are others that abuse and trauma was not evident in their background. So we'd love to be able to answer the question, how does this happen and how can we prevent it? But I don't know that anyone really can.
Yeah. And that, unfortunately, is a little bit frightening because
it would be great to take those people and identify, okay, who are right. the people that are going to commit these crimes and engage in this horrible, horrendous behavior and separate them out. Unfortunately, we just can't do that. I think yeah. we see warning signs, but we really don't know because there's just some that just seem to have normal, idyllic childhoods that we can't really mm-hmm. pinpoint where it went wrong. And it would be great to be able to predict and prevent. Unfortunately, right. I don't know if that's ever going to be possible.
I don't either. Yeah. I always said I thought it would be fascinating to talk to somebody like Carrie Rawson, whose father is known as BTK, Dennis Rader. And I always thought, like, what was he like as a father? Like, if he's agitated at home, you know, is he snapping? Is he explosive? All those things I think would be really fascinating. Even understanding the link for trauma reasons, right? Like if you're a child growing up in that home with a father who's a serial killer, how is that child traumatized by behavior that he or she is experiencing in the home? So maybe yeah. one day, not that I want to see future for serial killings, but if there is, we want to see that kind of, it'd be right wonderful to see that kind of research.
Well, I think it's important and I'm familiar. I've seen Carrie on other podcasts and I've listened to her and I've read her book.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very informative when her father was apprehended. That was long before my time in the unit. So we didn't know. I mean, I know about the case and I'm obviously familiar with the work that was done.
Yeah.
But coming in many years later and working on my own cases, I worked on cases and the offenders were different than Dennis Rader. And I wondered what the difference was and why were they different and what was it like for the children of these offenders? And so hearing Carrie speak out is very enlightening to me. But I also think Carrie's experience with her father is going to be unique. And it not all children of serial killers are going to have the same experience that yeah. Carrie had. And what I think is so interesting about when Carrie speaks about her upbringing, and she talks about how the FBI or the BAU or somebody had said that there was no abuse in her background. I find that interesting because she said that's not true. Nobody had ever asked her about that. Mm-hmm. And I think it also maybe they were maybe looking and maybe back in the time, and it wasn't all that long ago, but maybe long enough people didn't recognize what abuse, the different forms that abuse comes in. So maybe there wasn't physical abuse, but perhaps emotional abuse, and all that. Those things are really important to understanding these offenders and maybe trying to recognize some of the characteristics. Although I don't think at any point in time you could describe Carrie, whatever her experiences were. I'm sure a lot of children have similar experiences, but that doesn't mean that their parent is a serial killer. So absolutely, I don't think anyone makes that leap at any point in time. Maybe some people like think that, but I think that's a rarity where somebody would make that leap, because my parent is abusive to me, they're a serial killer. I don't know, but it is important, I think, like somebody like Carrie speaking out, for us to try to understand the crime problem a little bit better.
I agree. And just the built-in defense mechanism of denial that people have, I agree with you. I don't think many people would ever make that leap, because denial would kick in and shame, and right, just won't go there. So,
and I think another thing, and it's not so much the children, but maybe people that know somebody, they feel that something's wrong, but they don't want to speak up in case they're wrong. You don't want to accuse somebody of something and then turn out that you've wrongfully accused them. So I think there's a reluctance when people see problems or have suspicions. They don't want to be wrong and make a wrongful accusation against someone. I understand that. I think that's human nature. So I think that kind of prevents people sometimes from coming forward when they think, gosh, that person, their behavior is troubling to me, or I'm noticing weird things. But then we kind of dismiss it and think, no, I must be wrong. I'm overreacting. I think there's a lot of that too.
So if people are listening to this and they ever did suspect or they see a behavior that's concerning, where would they come forward? How would they bring that information?
To their local police department. That would be the best, or whatever the investigative agency is that's asking for information, if they feel something, and then they can bring it forward. And what I will say is that at least they can say they've done it, and law enforcement can investigate and either rule in or rule out a particular person.
Right. Right. Well,
particularly if they have DNA. If it's a DNA case, we always say, if you provide us a name, all we need is a name.
Yeah.
And we can quickly rule in or rule out. So innocent parties will be ruled out very quickly. That's some of the things we always would tell, and we would advise local law enforcement agencies, if they have good forensic evidence, to put that out there, to make people rest assured that if you're wrong, it's okay, because we can rule out that person.
Well, I hope if anybody's listening to this, it impacts them in a way that they feel confident to ever step forward if they're in that position. So as you gained more experience as a profiler, as people, as we grow, we transform our life, we change, we see things differently. I'm curious to know, as you gained more experience profiling, how did you change the way that you approach the profiling to improve your accuracy?
Well, I think just seeing more cases and being exposed to more cases helped me become a little more accurate, because you could say, oh, I've seen this before. Mm-hmm. And we study a lot of different cases, solved, unsolved cases. I think that helps. And then, of course, I developed my own process utilizing what I thought my strengths were, and that was in the area of forensics. So it was always really important to me, particularly if I had a case that had a violent crime scene and autopsy results and lab results, to really focus on that, like focus on the crime scene and what happened between the offender and the victim, and try to piece that back together to gain a good understanding of the sequence of events. And of course, the autopsy is always really important. What injuries were caused? Are there defensive injuries? What injuries resulted in death? Was there any gratuitous violence? And so trying to interpret that as well. And then, of course, any lab results are always really important. So that became kind of how I would approach a case. And I think utilizing the strengths that I brought to the unit, and I think one of the reasons I was chosen for the unit was my background in forensics. And as you work on more cases, you just get better at it. it just prioritizing things and organizing things, it becomes less overwhelming as a big case. You know, sometimes a big case will come in and you've got volumes and volumes of investigative records to go through. And it's like, where do I even start? So then after you've done that a few times, it just gets a little bit easier. And especially working, we have crime analysts that we would work with that would help with that amount of work, helping to create timelines and things like that. So I just learning to work smarter, I guess, is the answer to that. And the exposure to more cases, the more you work, the more you see. And I do think it helps, you know, at the BAU, many of these cases that these agencies are working, they've never seen anything like them before. And it may be the first and only time a department has a specific kind of crime or serial murder that they've never addressed before. And the fact that the BAU, we see these all the time, we just bring that perspective to all these cases and can provide insight that they might not have because they've never seen those types of cases before.
Right. That makes sense. Right. That you can bring all of that experience and take it to them and then help them with the investigation. You know, this just came to me, but like sometimes you see on a crime show, a board, like a cork board, and there's like pictures of the victims and there's like a red line here and there. Like, have you ever had to like build out a visual board to help you like putting everything together, something like that?
I've never done a board, but when I mentioned the crime analysts that are embedded in these units, they will do things like that, a relationship chart. So I would have little charts of who's who in my files that help me to know what relationships were and who the victims were if you had multiple victims. So yeah, so in a way we kind of do that, but it's not as dramatic as having everything pinned up on a board. I mean, maybe I don't remember anybody in the unit ever doing that. To a police department once who was investigating a homicide, a very high profile homicide, and they had a board, a map of the entire area in this neighborhood on the board, and they put little pins in every single house that they had checked. Wow. You know, identified who lived there. And it was the most incredible amount of work I'd ever seen. There are pins all over the board, but every time that they were confident that they had cleared a house and identified everyone in that house and ruled out those people, they put a pin in the board, and it was incredible. So visuals can work for some people. And in my case, it was just maybe a little piece of paper or a chart that showed the different relationships, or a timeline chart is also really helpful. The crime analyst that I worked with on the Golden State Killer case created a big timeline chart for me, which was extremely helpful to refer to it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, and I agree. Right. It's subjective, whatever anyone's personal style is. You know, some people are more visual or not. I know for me, I'd be the person with the big board and all the pins in it. So I was curious, like I've heard other retired FBI agents who have worked crimes, and some of them have described almost feeling traumatized because they can't get the memory out of their mind. So I'm not asking you if you're traumatized, but curious if you've ever worked on a case that did kind of get stuck in your head, where you're waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning and, or having a nightmare or something that you just couldn't get out of your head.
Generally, no. I would say like I've never been traumatized by a crime itself. I think what would keep me up at night I'd wake up in the middle of the night, my mind would start racing, is really just focusing on the investigative aspects. Like, okay, I start thinking about it. Okay, what have I missed? And, you know, thoughts will occur to me and my mind just can't shut off. So I think that's really how the work impacted me in terms of being traumatized by the work. I can't say that I was. What I will say, there were certain times in conducting an investigation, this was particularly when I was part of a member of the crime scene teams, and I would respond to the scenes themselves. Because the BAU, you often don't go to the scenes. You're coming in long after the fact. Many of the cases that we work are unresolved, and they've been unresolved for many years. So you may not actually ever get to see the crime scene in person. But as a member of the evidence response team, I would. And what would hit me occasionally are the personal items of victims or their personal effects. And the thought that these, like, particular victim was just living a normal everyday life with no idea about what was going to happen to them. And then this tragedy happens to them. And I think sometimes that would hit me right in the middle of work. And I would have to just, you just have to shut your mind off. You just have to realize I'm starting to feel sad. This is getting to me. I'm getting a little choked up. You just put it out of your mind. So those are the moments, the personal effects of the victims. And like going through a child's backpack, or in one case, I worked a crime scene where an elderly couple had been shot and killed. And I went into the guest bedroom, and this was right around Christmas, and they had all their gifts wrapped for their grandchildren on the bed. And reading the tags was very difficult. Like, I saw them, like, okay, I just have to put this out of my head. They had so much joy wrapping these presents for their grandchildren. It was so exciting and just hit me. Life was, for this family, was never going to be the same again. The life for the community was never going to be the same again. And so those are the types of things. And I wouldn't say it would wake me up, but I'd have these moments of overwhelming sadness that I would have to put out of my head. That's what impacted me. And I think everybody's different in what affects them or what gets to them. I mean, some people, I think nothing gets to them, and other people,
right.
Other people have things, like maybe it is a gruesome sight or a particular injury or a particular type of victim. We all have our triggers. I can't say I was ever woken up. And I think I have good coping mechanisms. I compartmentalize pretty well. I feel it's important to keep exercising. I like to run, and that really clears my head. I tell my children, exercise is good for your mind, body, and soul. And I know that I feel very strong. I'm not like crazy marathon runner or anything like that, but to get out and do exercise is really good for me. And I think that keeps me emotionally stable to some extent. And then I have a really good family support system. And also, I think too, it's just how I'm made. I've always just had a very positive attitude. I've generally been a very happy person and good childhood. So I think too, that's just sometimes that's how I am. We're all different. So.
Well, that tells me you're definitely the right person for the job.
Enjoy it. It was all I ever wanted to do. So I felt like I found the place I belonged in the work, doing the work that I was meant to do. And I feel very fortunate. I think that's another aspect. I just felt so fortunate that I had the opportunity to do what I always wanted to do from a very young age.
Right. Yeah, I think you and I have in common. We both read Mindhunter from John Douglas. And I think
I sure did.
Had a profound impact on your life, right? I know it did on mine too.
It did. I had several books that I read. First was Helter Skelter, which got me interested in true crime. And I knew somehow I wanted to be investigating murders in some way, shape, or form. And then I read a book called The Blooding by Joseph Wamba that got me interested in forensic science and working in a lab. And then, of course, Mindhunter, which made me very interested in criminal profiling. So books that I read did really dictate my life. So,
right. This is like a little spinoff from this conversation. Because you worked on such high profile, gruesome detail cases that had gruesome crime scenes, sometimes I'm curious if anything scares you, right? Like, it's not like you owned an ice cream shop. So like because of the work, what did or what does scare you? What spooks you?
Nothing really scares me. I think if I have any kind of fear in my life, I worry about my children. I don't worry that my children are going to meet with a serial killer, because I do know serial murder is a rare occurrence. But when they walk out the door every day, or they, you know, get in a car behind the wheel, I worry. So I think those things, just like everybody else, scares me. I think I have my own worries. Like, I don't, this is just going to sound so silly, but dying by knife wound is probably would be my worst fear. So having seen what I've seen, I think, that's not the way I want to go. So yeah, so you do sort of, if you let your mind wander too much, you'd start to really kind of terrify yourself. So I try not to do that. But I think mostly my worries are just my worries as a parent. and the things that I can't control when involving my children. And I try not to control their lives too much, but I have trouble sleeping if they're out or if it's bad weather and I know they're driving to school or something. That scares me, like any parent.
Yeah, no, I can relate to all of your comments about crimes involving knives and also being a parent.
Yeah.
And being a parent as well. It's scary when you think about your children going out into the world, especially knowing in cases of serial murder, many of these offenders, and we'll stereotype and say men, they're in the community. They can be in the church. They can be business owners, right? And so I think for me, because they can switch on and switch off, you don't know who your children might be coming across in any particular day.
Right. And there are many offenders that situate themselves so they can be near their preferred type of victim. So I think about that as well. I mean, I don't go around thinking that every person around my child is out to hurt them. I don't think that at all, but I'm aware of that. I'm aware that there are certain types of offenders that do that. And again, that, you know, the percentages are low, but we know they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I don't want to scare parents out there and make them think that any person out there that's volunteering for, you know, children or with your kids is a bad person. Not at all.
No.
Not at all. It's a rarity. But when those things happen, it's really high profile because it scares people because it's like, wow, this is, you know, this could happen to us. This could be my child. And so I think that's how we relate to it.
Well, that too. And I was thinking about your comment a few minutes ago about feeling sad when the personal effect of someone whose life is suddenly interrupted. I think you said the community as well, right? There is trauma to the community because
absolutely,
I think that kind of plays into that as well. And
yeah,
with that said, I was thinking too, if you're the parent, now that we're on this subject and not trying to scare people, but I think raising awareness is good and providing education. If someone is the parent of a daughter, and I'm just using this to be more specific, and she's going off to college, thinking about safety and security, is there anything that you would say to that parent that can help lower the risk of that person being the victim of a violent crime?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, we should be able to send our children and young women out into the world, and they should be safe. And the onus should be on these offenders not to engage in this behavior. But unfortunately, it's not like that. So, you know, having worked in higher ed for a while investigating sexual assault, the one thing I can say is that a common denominator was alcohol involved. I'm not saying that these crimes would have happened had alcohol not been involved, but many times it is involved. So I do think that is a risk factor. So educating young people about the use of alcohol and the dangers and things like that. And the other thing I would say in terms of anyone going out into the world and developing relationships is to, you know, build in them the confidence to recognize when someone is trying to make them feel bad for how they feel. So I feel like it's a real warning sign when you're dealing with someone and they're making you feel guilty because you feel a certain way. You don't want to do something and they like, oh, what do you mean you don't want to go on a date with me? Or what do you mean? Are you scared of me? Or I've seen that behavior before. And I think that's a real warning sign. So making our children or young adults aware that don't let anyone make you feel bad for how you feel. And if they do, that's someone you need to put distance between, you know, put distance between yourself and that person because that's manipulative behavior. So don't feel guilty because you don't want to hang around somebody or you don't want to go participate in a certain activity or you don't want to hang out with somebody or go on a date with them. Just don't feel bad about it. Feel confident enough to say, this is how I feel and you're not going to make me feel bad about that. And you want to be associating yourselves with people that support your feelings and understand your feelings. Say, oh, okay, I understand. And they don't push and they don't make you feel bad and they don't try to manipulate you. So I think those are the types of things I try to tell my children about, particularly they're both of college age. So I don't want anyone to make them feel bad for who they are and what how they feel.
Yeah, I can make a couple of comments about that. As a therapist for a while, I was receiving referrals from the local college in my area, and I was working with victims of sexual assault, and I would say at least 9 out of 10 of those cases, alcohol was involved. And again, we're not blaming the victim or shaming the victim, just pointing out the awareness, as you said, that alcohol was a big factor in the victim's ability to understand the risk that she might have been in or read the room, sort of. And then the other thing is, I call that the comments about being aware of people who might be manipulative is the problem is if somebody is taught to people please, right?
Right.
People pleasing is a problem. I want you to see me as good, or, you know, someone who's trying to get love or attention or feel like they're good enough is more willing to say things they don't really mean or go along with a plan that maybe they don't really want to do, but they want to do it because they want to be liked. And I think that's a real problem that can
Right. Or they're afraid of or sensitive about hurting someone's feelings. Mm-hmm. Or they feel like, again, it's kind of going back to this sense of, am I overreacting? Am I being silly? And
yeah.
So like doubting ourselves. But I guess it's just, you know, trust in your feelings. And but yeah, people pleasing, we just don't want to hurt people's feelings. We don't want to speak up. People don't want to be singled out and ostracized because they're not going along with the crowd. That's really hard. That's not an easy thing to deal with, to speak up and be that one person. It's extremely isolating and scary to be that person. And nobody wants to be that person. We all want to fit in.
Oh, completely.
At least I do.
No, me too.
I get along with everybody. I want everybody to love me.
Yeah, you know? Of course. Yeah. It's a sense of belonging. We all need,
right.
Actually, part of being human, and we need to feel like we belong. And you're right. And so because of that almost biological drive, it's hard to turn that off. But we really have to listen to that intuition or to that gut feeling, which is that inner compass of awareness that something might be wrong, and mm-hmm. try to tune into that and listen to that inner voice a little bit.
And don't be afraid to just, like, if somebody is invaded your comfort zone and you feel like, oh, I don't want to hurt their feelings, don't be afraid to just step away, move away from them. Don't be afraid to say, I'm not comfortable with that. And a reasonable person will understand that, and they'll probably feel bad. They'll be, oh, I'm sorry. So right. Sorry I made you uncomfortable. So I know that if somebody said that to me, I would just be like, I completely understand. I apologize if I made you uncomfortable. So it's hard to do.
Yeah. And just one more comment about this, because I think it's so fascinating, is that when I work with clients that have what we call now big T trauma and little T, like in the past, most people thought of just big T trauma, which was, let's say, sexual abuse. But now we realize that trauma can also come in other forms, like you kind of mentioned earlier, emotional, right? And,
right.
You know, the impact of if you have a parent and that parent gets angry because you got a low grade in school and the parent takes away their love. And all of a sudden now your parent's not talking to you for a week. Well, that's a form of trauma. And what I've noticed is working with clients who have trauma, they have a really hard time with boundaries. So again, what you basically are just saying is having really good boundaries.
Yeah, know what's right for you and stick up for that. Stick up for yourself. And I don't mean you have to yell at somebody or be rude or mean. And we all have our ways that we try to be direct with people and we do our best. But yeah, it's put your boundaries up and don't compromise.
Love it. Love it.
Easier said than done. I understand that, but that's what I try to tell my children too.
Nice.
It's just, you know, set those boundaries and situational awareness. Just realize when something's not right and don't be afraid to get yourself right out of that situation as quickly as you can.
Oh, I love that. That's being mindful, being really mindful to,
right.
to your surroundings.
Well, I'll tell you that it is not easy. As a young person, that is not easy to do. I mean, I found myself in situations as a young person. I'm like, why did I do that? Why, you know, why didn't I just, you know, I could have made a better choice there. And so, you know, but this is me reflecting back on a 22-year career as an FBI agent. And, you know, now I'm 54 years old and I have like a lot of life experience and a lot more wisdom. It's really easy for me now to set boundaries. I have no problems now.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I can relate to him thinking.
It takes time. It's so easy as an adult to tell younger people, these are the mistakes you need to avoid, that you do this, and this. And it's not as easy when you're 18 years old.
Yeah, I have a big smile on my face that you can't see right now. Because I'm laughing because if any of my friends from high school are actually listening to this, they would be like, Melissa, come on. When you were a teenager, like, you know, to your point, yeah, now at 48 years old, I can certainly easy for me to sit here and look back. But yeah, I got you. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit and go back to the profiling, because there was something that you said in your podcast, The Console, that I thought was really, really kind of gave me a moment of pause. And it was that when you were analyzing a crime scene, there were times that you could tell the offender was emotionally immature. And I was so curious to ask you, like, what is it from the crime scene that you were able to extract that information?
Trying to think what case that was. In terms of like trying to age, like a lot of times the TV presents a profile as, oh, the offender is between the ages of 25 or 35. And you know, over the years, I think we've gotten away from trying to put a chronological age on an offender. And it's more about, okay, their emotional maturity and how are they going to interact with people around them that know them outside the crime they committed. And I think there are just certain aspects of crimes where you say, okay, this person is likely a little more emotionally immature, particularly in cases. And we see this a lot. Most of the cases involved these people with these types of characteristics, but this complete disregard for a victim. And it's obvious that this person's needs come before anybody else's. And that's many of the cases that we saw. We could see that just based on what they did to their victim. They didn't care. And I think that speaks to emotional immaturity. Now, there's also some aspects of crimes where you see, okay, this is a more experienced offender. They were evidence conscious, or they were more, you know, it was a more organized offense. And so perhaps they may be a little bit more mature or emotionally mature or criminally sophisticated because they've been doing these crimes for a while. So there's so many factors that go in to, at least I don't want to say, I'm going to use the word age in air quotes, into trying to determine like how old an offender could potentially be or how much they've developed emotionally or not. And you may have an offender who is offending in their late 30s, early 40s or something like that. And they're extremely emotionally immature. Many of our offenders are like that. I could probably put that on every profile, emotionally immature. Not everyone.
Right. Because I understand what you're saying, right? Like not caring about the victim. I mean, obviously none of them, right, care about the victim or they wouldn't be doing what they were doing.
I think there's sometimes you may have offenders that maybe do have some empathy or are, you know, have extreme emotions perhaps. Okay. But then you have ones that just do not care at all. They could care less. And those are the types of people that this kind of characteristic is going to bleed over into their everyday life. And you're going to see that in their interactions daily with family members, coworkers, strangers, that they just go through life and they don't care about anybody else at all.
Yeah, I can see how that information would be useful mm-hmm. when trying to build that profile of narrowing down suspects or.
Yeah. And this is an extreme example in this, but there's a case where an offender, he shot and killed two little girls and they were early teen, 11 and 13, and they had done nothing wrong. They were very low risk victims. Yeah. And it was a brutal, cold-hearted crime. And it takes, you just think about that when you kind of think about the process and what actually happened. And this is very gruesome, but what kind of person would shoot point blank two girls in their heads? You know, who would do that? What kind of person? A horrible person, right?
Yes.
But when you kind of extrapolate that, what kinds of behaviors are you going to see in their normal everyday life? You're going to see, I'm not saying to the extreme where they've actually killed anybody else, but you're likely to see extreme examples of their behavior. And in this particular case, interviewing this offender, once he was identified, interviewing his past romantic partners, you know, one woman described trying to break up with him over the phone. And what he did is he tells her that he is going to kill himself, and he shoots his gun. And she's on the phone with him thinking that he has killed himself and that she's the cause of it. And as you can imagine how horrifying that would be to, you know, a normal person. And he gets back on the phone with her laughing and saying, you know, what's the matter? What's no big deal? And this is an extreme example, but when I'm talking about emotionally immature and no regard for anybody else's feelings, you know, the offender that killed these two girls is the same person that did that in a romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. And like I said, that I think that's just such a great example. And there are examples out there that are not as extreme. But that's how you kind of look at it. This is the immaturity. I mean, that's just not only emotionally immature, but it's absolutely no regard or understanding at all about what you have just done to somebody else. You've probably traumatized this young woman for the rest of her life.
Yeah, I mean,
for doing that, what you thought was a joke, which he knows, he knew it wasn't a joke. He was trying to absolutely terrorize her.
Yeah, it's incredibly sadistic.
Yeah. So I hope that makes sense. For me, it's always really good to, rather than just kind of talk about the concepts, to just give an example of this is what I mean. This is what we say when we say emotionally immature and this person has no regard for anybody else. Here's a perfect example. And that was my profile. And I was very adamant, you are going to see examples that people that know this offender will have extreme examples of times where he has acted in a way that was completely inappropriate for the situation, a complete overreaction. And I didn't know what those actually would look like, but when he was identified, that was an example. That's what that looks like.
Yeah, that's super helpful. I mean, even with my work as a therapist, if somebody came in as a client and said, well, person I'm dating is emotionally immature, I would, same thing. I'm like, I need examples because it helps me to understand again, like the impact of that behavior on what she's experiencing. Right.
So yeah,
that was very
helpful. There's different examples of emotionally immature. It's a continuum. You know, what I do that's emotionally immature is nothing compared to what this offender did. And that's why we're looking at, okay, that's all we have. When we get these cases, we only have that snapshot in time of behavior they engaged in.
Yeah.
And we have to extrapolate from that behavior.
Right.
And all I kept thinking is, who would do this? What kind of person would do this to these two little girls with absolutely really no good reason? They were very low risk. And not that there's ever a good reason, but they were low risk victims. And so you extrapolate that out and it can be difficult to do because you're extrapolating it from a moment in time. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that our behavior and personality traits and characteristics are reflected in our repeated patterns of behavior. So you may have this one instant, but what can we extrapolate from that? And that's what we try to do with the profiling, which I will also point out is why it's not an exact science at all. It's a soft science.
Yeah, right. I understand.
Not a hard science. Yeah.
For that example, too, just one more comment, too, is that behavior, what that behavior says is, you're making me do this, or that behavior is saying, it's your fault if I hurt myself. So I'm not responsible at all. There's no personal responsibility. I'm not responsible for my own choices or how I choose to react to the stress of the breakup. It's your fault. And like, that is a very distinct personality type for people.
Yes, exactly. And it's extremely emotionally immature to blame your actions on somebody else.
I always say in therapy that I'm very cautious for people that blame others and justify their bad behavior, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to help them become their best self, put it that way. So the other question I had for you is, I know that there are female killers, but have you come across cases of a female sexual sadist who might have engaged in necrophilia or body dismemberment after death? I've always personally associated those type of sexual sadist serial killer crimes with men, but I was wondering if you come across females that engaged in those type of behaviors.
So I have not. I have had a case where a female did dismember romantic partners and tried to destroy them through burning their body parts, but I'm not certain that it was sexually motivated. I don't know. I think there was a financial motive, certainly. But yeah, I haven't really, that would be very unique. And I have never worked a case like that or assessed an offender that a female that had engaged in that kind of behavior. Now, what I have seen is females that go along with their male partners. I've never seen, not aware of necrophilia or the dismemberment usually is, you know, trying to get rid of evidence.
Yeah.
But I have, you know, I have seen female partners of male offenders engage in the behavior and help them commit their crimes, enable them, help them go along with it, participate in the assault. It's not a common thing that we would see at the BAU, but it's not something we've never seen.
Yeah. Well, you made me think of Carla Homoka and Paul Bernardo.
Well, that was... Yeah, that's one I was thinking of, that case. Exactly. She not only was part of the abduction process, but she engaged in, you know, sexual assault of these victims as well.
Yeah, so that's actually one case. If I had to pick a case that kind of got stuck in my head, it was the torture of her sister and the death of her sister that I found really disturbing. So
yeah, actually, now that you mentioned that case, there, I had read many, many years ago. I think it was even before I was in the FBI. Not exactly sure of the timeline, but I read a book about it and they had videotaped their assaults of these victims. And this book was going into great detail of the assaults on these victims. And these victims were young women. I think the only true crime book that I didn't finish. It was still too much for me. So I think that's what got to me. I just can't. I'm glad I didn't have to view the videos as part of my work ever. But there are detectives out there, investigators out there that had to do that.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
I can't imagine how. So, you know, do I have my limits? Probably.
Okay.
I guess I'm like, oh, nothing bothers me. But yeah, I mean, I couldn't finish the book. I mean, this is just too horrifying. And I think if I was doing it for work, I'd be able to do it and I would get through it. And somehow afterwards, I'd probably go for a long run and hope to put it out of my mind. But,
yes,
you know, that is the one thing that I don't want to say I avoided it, but, you know, I didn't have an interest in working crimes against children. A lot of the work that the FBI does, it's really phenomenal work by phenomenal people or you know, sexual exploitation of children. And you know, a lot of times that results in hands-on offenses. And that was something I did not want to work because I think that would have been a very short time period that I probably would have been able to mentally handle that type of work.
Yeah. When I made my comments earlier about researching interviews of retired agents that did actually experience trauma from the job, it was exactly that. It was those who had worked on those child serial killing cases.
Yeah. And I purposely applied to the, you know, when I was looking to go to the BAU, I did not want to be in the crimes against children unit. I wanted to be in the crimes against adults unit specifically. I would not have wanted a job in that. And then when I was kind of to go back to the training that we did at BAU, we have to work cases in each of the units. And so I did have to work a couple of cases in the crimes against children's unit. Yeah. One of them being that double homicide that I just mentioned, the shooting deaths of the two girls. And I was always specifically interested in that case because I had read about it in the news. So when it did come in to the unit and the local authorities were requesting BAU assistance, I specifically asked to be assigned to that case. And I think, number one, it was more along the lines of, I'm going to say, a traditional homicide. There was not a sexual assault involved, and it was not child exploitation. So it was more along the lines of what I was used to working. But then, you know, a lot of the work that the Crimes Against Children's Unit does at BAU is child exploitation. And I think that's one of the most difficult violations to work.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to that.
Yeah.
Because we can see that child who's exploited in our own children or our neighbor's children or our friend's children. So I understand
right.
that. Yeah.
I just was able to, I guess, navigate it. So I was never assigned to work those violations and I never volunteered to work those violations. So I was able to avoid probably any significant issues or that I might have had stemming from my job.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. That helps me to go back into the victimology question because I had heard you say one time when you were doing another interview that you wish there was more victimology, and the investigators sometimes find some questions to be too sensitive. And I was curious, what are those sensitive questions that you feel like would be more helpful if they were asked when you were trying to profile a case?
Well, certainly it's hard to ask certain questions because you don't want to sound like you're victim blaming, but there, it's important for us to know like sexual histories of victims. You know, we really want to know everything about a victim that's possible. And whether it's their personality, the good and the bad about them, not just all the good qualities, but the bad qualities as well. You know, did they overreact to things? Were they mean to people? We want to know all that. Their lifestyle. You know, how did they live? What were their attitudes and their values? What was important to them? You know, who were their friends and family, and who were they closest to, and who did they not have good relationships and why? You know, what did they do for a living? What was their economic status? What was their physical description? That can come into play as well. Are they being selected as a victim because of characteristics that they don't have control of, like the color of their skin or their hair color, things like that? Their daily habits. What were their daily routines, and what were their means of transportation and communication and all of this? And it is really important for us to know all that so that we can assess that victim's particular risk and where in their life. What is there anything that in their life exposed them to more risk? And understanding that is extremely important, and it can be difficult. And it also can be difficult for people that are being interviewed about a victim because we don't, you know, people, it's kind of human nature. You don't want to say something bad about somebody that's passed away. You don't want to sound like you're dragging their name through the mud.
Yeah.
So to speak. So it's really important. I think a lot of the cases that we had, it really lacked victimology. And again, going back to the one case I've already referenced with the two girls, that's one thing I had investigators go back and do is I sent out questionnaires to the investigators. And I said, please hand these questionnaires out to people that knew these girls, whether it's family, teachers, friends, so I can get a better idea about their victimology. Because there were a lot of rumors going around about why they were targeted. And I wanted to kind of get to the bottom of that. And what I learned from them is that all the rumors that were going around were just that. They were just rumors being spread by people that didn't really know the victims. And it turned out they were very low risk victims. They were adored by their families. They weren't involved in, you know, any kind of relationships or sexual relationships, or they weren't involved in drugs or alcohol. And that really helped with their victimology, because what I was able to determine is that there's nothing in their life that put them at risk. And they were at risk because of the location that they were that day that they came across the offender. So it was really my opinion that the motive was formed right at that moment by the offender. So something happened between the offender and these victims that caused this offender to feel he needed to kill them. And so that's why victimology is so important. It's not all necessarily because it's bad stuff. It's just kind of trying to rule out things in their life and rule out the rumors and really get to the heart of who these people were it's extremely important. It's a big part of the work that we do, particularly when we're trying to assess a crime.
All your comments were so incredibly thought-provoking, because I was thinking, like, as a therapist, often when people come into therapy, I see that shadow self. Like, people don't always show all parts of themselves, right? Like, their friends and family might not know things about them in private, but they come into therapy and I hear it. And like, I had a client one time who was having severe panic attacks. And as I'm collecting and analyzing all this information, I couldn't make a connection of where it was coming from. And I find out, you know, 9 months into therapy, that she was very privately doing escort work. So to your point, like, that was information that, like, friends and family might not know about, but
right.
Or maybe one person, maybe there was just one friend who kind of heard or knew. And I can see why that information is so incredibly important, because you might want to go look in that direction to see if the offender knew her, for example, from that type of work.
Right. And the work that you do and the work that I did, we're only as accurate or as good at our job as the information that we're getting. And if the information is incomplete or not accurate, then the work that we do will be incomplete and maybe not accurate or maybe not appropriate for that particular client that you have. So trying to get as much information as possible. And some people may not even know, like, some of these questions on these questionnaires are not necessarily troubling questions, but they're just routine questions, but they can give you a lot of information about how somebody might react to something. Or I had a victim who was in one career and was thinking of changing careers. And this was something that was weighing very heavily on her, and it was bothering her. And she wasn't, this is coming from a friend who filled out the questionnaire.
Yeah.
But it was weighing heavily on her. It was really bothering her. And she had been kind of going back and forth with this decision for a long time. She was really coming to this realization. Well, what that told me is that we had a very conscientious person who was not impulsive. She wasn't just going to just drop one career and go do something else. And so even that, like, maybe that little bit that the friend provided told me about this victim. And so these questionnaires, maybe the people filling them out don't actually realize how useful some of the information, these little tidbits about them, clarify for us.
Yeah, really. Yeah, it gives you a fuller picture of the person and
exactly
what their life was like.
Yeah, so this is not an impulsive person. She's not going to go make a quick decision. She's going to think about things very carefully. And so somebody like that, you know, when you kind of look at it just sort of in a vacuum, it's okay, maybe she's a little lower risk victim. It's all helpful.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So interesting. I could literally talk to you about that for an hour. Okay. So I know we're almost up on time. I wanted to ask, what do you think is the public's fascination with serial murder?
I think there's different factors that go into that. I think, first of all, people love mysteries, or many people love mysteries. We become invested in those mysteries and wanting to have those mysteries solved and our questions answered. I think that's a huge aspect to being fascinated with them. I think to most people, hopefully, serial killers commit unspeakable crimes and unspeakable acts. And we want to understand, kind of going back to what we talked about earlier, understand why and how they become that way. How did this happen? How can we prevent it? And how can we avoid the danger? So I think that's also another part of this fascination, you know, just trying to understand how can somebody be like, even the cases that I've worked, I still don't quite understand. I just have this like understanding, yep, people are like that. But do I really truly understand it? I don't think I ever really could. And unless you're somebody like that, I don't think we really will ever understand it. I think another aspect to it as well is that we empathize with the victims and the victims' families, and we want to see justice for the victims, and we want to see justice for the offender as well. We want to see somebody, I know for me, I get such great satisfaction seeing somebody get caught for their crimes. And being held accountable. There's part of me that thinks, well, maybe they don't really care, but it is extremely satisfying to identify that person. So I think justice is a big reason. We want to see that. So those are my theories, and I'm, that's really just coming from my, I think, my own personal thoughts on it, and why I think I've been fascinated with it. Certainly the whole reason I got in to law enforcement in this line of work is because I have a strong sense of justice, and I do want to see people held accountable for their bad acts. I think that's probably my number one reason for this fascination, is I love a mystery, and I love to see how these cases get solved and the great work that so many investigators out there have done in all these different cases that I've had an opportunity to study or read about or even be a part of working on.
I suspect many people would probably agree with you with all those things. I think it makes total sense. I had read a research study one time that quite a few people who listen to true crime, it's actually to learn also how to protect themselves and lower their risk of being a victim. So all of those things that you said totally make sense.
It's hard to say exactly.
Right. It is. I know
everyone's, I guess, different, but it is kind of a phenomenon. You sort of wonder, why are we fascinated? But we are.
Yes, we are, definitely, as a society. Mm-hmm. I guess my last question for you is, do you plan to ever write a book? And also, can you speak a little bit about your podcast and how people can connect with you?
Sure. As far as writing a book, I have thought about it, not seriously, but I've thought about taking some of the stuff I've done and fictionalizing it, perhaps, because I think a fiction book would be a little bit easier. So I've thought about it. Whether I ever do it, I don't know. Probably not, but who knows? Who knows?
I hope you do. I want to read it.
I just don't know what kind of format it would be. And I really admire people that write books, whether it's fiction or they're historical. Somebody had suggested writing a book on the history of the BAU, which I think, that would be really interesting. I kind of know it. I know some anecdotal stories, and that would be kind of fun. But I don't know. I don't know if I could just sit down and do it, but maybe someday. And my podcast is called The Consult, Real FBI Profilers. So what it is, I have other retired profilers that I worked with in the unit that are part of the show. And we discuss cases that are both solved and unsolved. Many of the cases are cases that we actually worked on. We are starting to branch out a little bit and start looking at cases that we hadn't previously profiled before. But it really is, how I would describe it is, it's like being in the room. It's the closest you get to being in the room with the FBI's BAU. It's very real. It's not scripted. I mean, sometimes I have like a little timeline that I've scripted out for, for the facts of the case, but it's unscripted. It's really talking and working through cases and discussing of behaviors. For the cases that are solved, we'll talk about the offender who is ultimately identified and where the profile was right or wrong. I mean, generally our profiles are fairly close, but we don't hit everything for sure. And sometimes there are cases, and we're going to cover a few that we completely missed. So I think that's interesting, because we learned from that and we can explain, well, why did we miss? So that's our show. We're on, all the different apps you could listen to podcasts on. It, again, is called The Consult. Oh, and then I should also say that I occasionally do some interviews with people. It's all, in true crime, and I have them tell their stories about the cases that they've worked on. And then occasionally we will also do this, because part of our job at BAU is training, to provide training to law enforcement and other entities. And so occasionally we'll throw in a show where we just discuss a certain topic. Like, we have one called Profiling Concepts, which we talk about all the different concepts that people will hear when we're doing our consults. And then we've recently just released a couple episodes just on serial murder, which I thought would be interesting. We recorded it after a suspect in the Long Island serial killer case was arrested. I thought it would be a good time to just kind of talk about serial murder in general and based on our own experiences and observations working these types of cases.
I have listened to every episode and I validate what you said. I truly feel like I'm in the room as a guest listening to the conversation, and it's thought provoking and fascinating. So you're welcome. Anyone listening to this, please listen to the consult.
It's not one of those podcasts. Like, I do like some of the podcasts that just tell a story. You can just kind of listen and it's just, you zone out. Like this one, you kind of have to listen to, and then like, oh, if I miss something, you might have to go back. It's a discussion.
If anyone is listening to this and they have a case that they would like you to review, do you take suggestions?
We do take suggestions, and we actually have taken some suggestions. However, I will put out the caveat is that if we don't have access to, let's say, certain information, like if a crime scene photos or autopsies, we can't do it. Now, we've taken on cases of missing people because there wasn't a traditional crime scene and we knew what had happened. And so we've been able to look at those types of cases. But each case we will look at individually and say, okay, do we have enough information to do something with this case and do it, you know, to do it justice, rather than just trying to throw out a bunch of speculation because we don't know the answers to many of our questions. So,
right. So if you can't take a case, that is the reason why.
I usually will tell people, oh, there's just not enough information. But then there's been a couple of times where people have asked us to take a look at the case. And these are going to be some upcoming episodes. And I've reached out to the police department and they do want to participate with us on the consult. Awesome. And really to put a spotlight back on like some of these unresolved homicides that they have. So that has been nice. I'll always check. I'll always check if someone wanted to participate or work with us or have us, you know, provide some of the services that we're able to provide, you know, and if not, I'll just say we just couldn't do it. We couldn't do it justice.
Well, it sounds like there's more exciting things for the consult coming in the future. I can't wait to see how it transforms.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. So Julia, thank you so much for your time today and sharing your knowledge, your expertise. This has been amazing.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation. Very different type of a conversation than I'm used to having. So I really enjoy your show and I wish you best of luck on your own podcast.
Thank you. Good. Because that's how I was hoping it would be unique in that way. So I appreciate
it. It's very unique. I think it's going to be a big success and hopefully we can collaborate on something in the future.
I would love that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Bye.